Are you ready? I redrew our little diagram. Adding, this was one of the big changes, that it's not the Father, it's the Self. Father just being one image that expressed it. That's to drive home the fact that this whole thing is not about Father as fact, but Father as symbol. Father being a form of a hero, that's supposed to say hero up there, and that's what we'll be talking about for quite a while. The hero has as its main characteristic the death and rebirth theme. That's where we left off. We will start pretty soon looking at the third text that she came up with, but before we do that, just some comments about her personally, now kind of leaving our collective angle for a bit, our mythological angle, just talking about what this means for her for a moment. Part of the psyche really wants the external object, but another part of it strives back to the subjective world where the airy and lightly built palaces of fantasy beckon. What he's driving at for her is, now, the key for health is going to be not this, which Freud would have said means that she's avoiding something, remember, but can she understand this that's being generated in order to move her energy into the future? She can't. The danger is that you get so fascinated with what comes up that that itself begins to lead you away from reality, and that's a psychosis. So the presence of the imagery, as I said, isn't the issue. The issue is whether you can interpret it or whether you get addicted to its aesthetic beauty, which is a real problem in certain circumstances. Sometimes the tendency is to literalize what is given, or sometimes the problem is to get just transfixed and obsessed with the image that comes up and not be able to move it into its meaning. So that's what he means by part of the psyche wants the external object, meaning her relationship to that guy, and part of it strives back to the subjective world where the airy and lightly built palaces of fantasy beckon. That would be the poetry that she's writing. And what she does, she gets stuck in the poetry and never asks what it means. Again, more about her problematic relationship to this process. Paragraph 254, we see in Miss Miller, a tendency that scorns real solutions and prefers a fantastic substitute. The external object simply cannot be loved because an overwhelming proportion of the libido prefers an internal object that rises up from the unconscious as a substitute for the missing reality. Now, see, there he's a little bit Freudian, a substitute for the missing reality. That's not really his main point. But his main point would be that rather than deal with her attraction to men, which Jung is now saying, yeah, I can see that's a real problem. What she does is she lives in these images she creates rather than transforms through them. Saying the same thing, paragraph 262, the neurotic attitude wants to overlook unpleasant facts and unhesitatingly risks a whole chain of pathological symptoms for the sake of some small advantage in the present. Okay, now comes the last text that we'll talk about from her, and it reads as follows. Suddenly, the apparition of an Aztec with a headdress. His name was Chewantable. The figure of Chewantable comes up on horseback. An Indian creeps forward stealthily. making ready to shoot an arrow at Jawantabal, who bares his breast to him in an attitude of defiance. And the Indian, fascinated by this sight, slinks away and disappears into the forest. So that's bad news. The bad news is that Jung has tried to establish that the nature, the real meaning of the hero is the death and rebirth theme. But here, rather than the ability to die and let the old pass, in other words, what you've got in its stead is arrogant display. And that's where she gets short-circuiting. So it's not, again, the production of this image. It's that image reflects her infantility and unwillingness to consider who she is internally. We'll be talking more about that. Just another detour segue to what is supposed to be going on here. I think, again, it's a big point of Jung's difference with most, I think it's most psychologists, you can see what you think, is that for him, the personality is created unconsciously, not consciously. Do you see what's so important about that? Well, for Jung, you, in this process, you are presented with who you are. You have control insofar as you can accept or reject. And you have control insofar as you have to take the steps to put it into reality. But who you are is something that's given to you, not something that you create out of choice and willpower. Once you are formed by this inner process, which shows you its conclusion about who you are in the form of these images, then you have to do the work. But the actual creation of the potential that you will be utilizing or making real is something that's given. That's a huge difference in you.
Is this like, are you saying that like when you give that definition of an archetype, like the potential of crystal, are you saying then that the archetype of our ego of ourselves carries the potential of,
yes,
and we don't have to say in it?
No.
I didn't know that. Where did he say that? Can you think where did he say that a little bit?
I can think of two places immediately where he talks about it in terms of what he calls our ground plan,
okay,
the plan of who we are, being there before birth. I don't think I could give you the paragraph. If you want, email me and I'll, there's an email link on my website, okay, and I'll send it to you. One is in volume, I believe it's 9-1. And the other is in the Children's Dream Seminar.
In what?
The Children's Dream Seminar, which is an unpublished manuscript, but I could send you the sentence.
Thank you.
Yeah, maybe we should stress that if it's not clear to everybody, that for Jung, the self is prior to experience. The word he uses is a priori, a before priori experience.
So our life is just to fulfill what has already been put in place?
Right.
What if we don't do it?
The choice is to accept to do that or not to do it. It's not Presbyterian predestination. It's a potential. What happens? You know, that's a tough question. Jung says something which some people find offensive, but we need to look at it anyway, that all people aren't created equal. Where he puts it, his nature is aristocratic. Now, he doesn't mean it that it's not about money, you know, it's not about social status. It's about somehow people are born with varying gifts to give to the community. And I think if you're lucky enough to be born with no particular gift for the community, nothing happens. If you were born with a gift to give to the community, a lot happens. I think this is where real suffering starts, when you are to be somebody and you refuse to be that person. To the extreme of physical mishaps and disease. But it's something we certainly try to examine. Who's this person to be, and are the problems they're facing because they're refusing that step into the future? Not so much what caused it, but is this the result of their having refused an invitation, so to speak?
It just made me think that perhaps we're not always sure about the invitation.
No, we're not.
We're getting.
Right.
Because I had been thinking something earlier about something in my own life that I thought, well, this is what if they're telling me this is what I'm supposed to do, but then I just now thought, well, maybe that's not really the mm-hmm. message that they've been trying to send to me, and mm-hmm. maybe I should be doing this other thing.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's
a pain.
The language mm-hmm. is kind of understanding the symbols.
Mm-hmm. Understanding the symbols. I can say, I think, in general, when you start out this inner journey, they tend to be pretty clear. As you go further, they become less clear. You never really know for sure, and what I think one has to do is form a hypothesis. Do they mean this? And then act on it and see what the result is. Watch for synchronistic response. Watch for synchronistic prohibitions. It's a trial and error.
And he says it can be deadly.
It can be deadly.
What is more deadly is to not do it and be dead.
If you are given a gift, I think there are consequences. Continuing the same thought, why he feels it's so important to have defined what he considers growth in this way. Consciousness is in danger of being led astray by its own light and becoming a rootless will-o'-the-wisp. Longs for the healing power of nature. Healing power of nature would be this symbol production process. And that's what we try to hook up with, so that we don't just choose to be anything, but we are able to choose the right thing for our life. Okay, that was sort of an excursion. Back to Miss Miller now. Now Jung is talking about how this process went wrong for her. Even though the process itself isn't wrong for her, it went wrong because of her attitude. We now understand what it was that turned against the naval officer. It was Miss Miller's spirituality, which, personified by the Aztec, was far too exalted for her ever to find a lover among mortal men. She will discover only later what the unconscious wants, and this will assert itself either as a change of lifestyle or as a neurosis or even a psychosis. So with her, this thing went wrong because the India now being another form of the, Chiwantable being another form of the hero is something that she identifies with. And rather seeing it as a symbol for her to go through her own process of transformation, she begins comparing other people to that ideal she herself has not realized, and in the face of that ideal puts them down and remains isolated. So that the process, rather than guiding her, actually ends up isolating her.
So do we ask ourselves then, is this taking an end of life, or is this taking an afterlife? Is our inner energy?
Yeah. And the trick is, in a way, it may take you out of life for a while, but is it taking me out of life to put me back into life a deeper person, or is it taking me out of life just so I feel special and so I can judge other people as being beneath a standard which I myself don't reach?
The myths of that are the woman who turns away all of the male human suitors and then ends up married to a demon.
Right. That's the, in folklore, it's called the demon lover. So you could say that this male image, this god, which we started out, and we're going to come back to seeing how it could work if it worked well, ends up working the wrong way and estranging her from life. So again, more of the same, 332. Is the causal interpretation of Freud correct in believing that symbol formation is to be explained as a mere substitute product? It is more a question of a phenomenon requiring a teleological explanation than of simple causes. Does that make sense to everybody? Teleological means goal-oriented. Where is this heading for her? That's how the interpretation should be.
This isn't in here, but where's the affect in this study? What kind of affect comes with?
Well, the affect would be not experienced with the man, experienced instead with this idealized guy she's carrying around herself. And so she's removed her affect from reality, and it lives in a fantasy system.
Yeah, but I'm curious whether there's a fear in the self. Which maybe is experienced and felt as fear of death.
Could be. The way Jung takes it more is not so much what she's afraid of, but what she's intoxicated with. And for him, this whole process leads to intoxication. But I think it'd be also safe to say she is afraid of death. And we're going to, you know, look more at what does it mean that the hero dies and is reborn. And I don't know whether to say she is intoxicated by the positive or fear of the negative, but whatever it is, it doesn't happen. I think Jung basically felt, more than anything, she just needed information. She didn't have the means to understand what this figure was. And so I think he would have said to her, just, you know, point directly, what I've said to you folks. This is not something you've accomplished. This is not a standard you can hold other men to. This is trying to tell you something. We've got to hear what it is. And stop judging other people in this way. And then see where it goes.
With one of the other process might be that she would have had a projection onto the surface of a hero, being named a hero.
Could.
And it could have been worked through that way.
Yes, could. You can see, in a way, the benefit of the Freudian position here. It would have circumvented all of this stuff by telling her it's all a fantasy, substitute, look at the reality, which is ultimately what she has to do. But Jung takes her kind of on a detour before she looks at reality to see that it's not something she should avoid but live through. But in a way, they both come back to the same thing. Although Jung then has, when he gets back to that, hopefully is giving her an image of herself rather than just taking her away from a false, is also giving her a positive.
I'm kind of wondering if that might just happen anyway, though.
If life goes on well, I think it does happen naturally. Problem is, what happens when it doesn't?
Yeah.
A kind of good descriptive sentence for Jung's starting point and where this is all different from religion is in paragraph 338. It is not possible to discuss the problem of symbol formation without reference to the instinctual processes, because it is from them that the symbol derives its motive power. You see the importance of that? What we've done is we've ended up with an image, but we started with an instinct, or a desire for that guy. And for Jung, that is the legitimate birth of a symbol. And a symbol is always tied to an instinctive process and should put us back in touch with it at the end, rather than receiving our imagery from a dogmatic schema. We don't start with the image, we start with our desire, and that leads to an image, but then that means we are not leaving our own power in the process. So we're always, as well as looking at the reality that needs to be addressed, asking ourselves, where is the energy in us that this is dealing with? The other side of it, when it works well, if the conscious mind now succeeds in interpreting the constellated archetype in a meaningful and appropriate manner, then a viable transportation. Good. Good.
You should never make mistakes.
This is the problem with teaching this material. You can't get away with anything. We'll call that a Jungian slip. A viable transportation can take place. I know, transformation.
Transformation
is a transportation, so it wasn't that far off.
Well, we started with the bridge.
Right.
No, that's right. This will do that to you. The story now turns to the hero, and let's take a look at what he's got to say. Why is it the hero who is appearing? We've talked about it, but now we're going to his text where he talks about it. Thus the fate of Osiris is explained. He enters into the mother's womb, into the coffer, that was the chest that he was thrown into, the sea, the tree, the Astarte column, that's the column that he, what's that?
What does that come from?
This?
That column. And symbolically. No. Is that the tree?
That's him as the... first he's washed up on the shore and a tree takes him in. Mm-hmm. He becomes part of the trunk of the tree. Mm-hmm. Then that tree is chopped down and becomes a column in the...
Oh, inside the house.
Inside the palace of the king. That's Osiris as the column. And it's basically a column, but then you see he's got his two hands to show it's Osiris. Is dismembered put together again, and reappears in his son. Son would be the, that's his son above, the falcon. And he's the son. S-O-N and S-U-N, both. This begins Jung's discussion of incest. So we're adding another layer onto our chain of symbolic thoughts. Let me review them, see if I can, it's like 101 bottles of beer in the wall. God, son, hero, death and rebirth. Is that everything? And now, where does he go when he's dead? He goes to his mother. Or he goes to images traditionally associated with mother. The ocean, the tree, the chest are examples that we've got on the table. So he's present in Miss Miller's visions to indicate the need for death and rebirth that I've said. But what will start appearing in dreams at this point is either death and rebirth or incest. So incest imagery can be a very typical way this part of the process is symbolized. So Jung is going to put in another detour to compare his idea of incest with Freud's idea of incest. Freud, if you remember, put at the center of psychological issues incest. The longing of the son for the mother, Oedipus complex, the longing of the daughter for the father, the Electra complex. That imagery appears now in this part of the process. Once again, the Freudian interpretation would be to jump on that and say, you see, you are in an unhealthy and regressive substitute for real life. You're going back to mommy because you can't face life. Jung is saying, no, the incest motif is an integral part of the hero cycle, because when the hero is killed, he goes back to a mother image, and very often, prior to that, he is the lover of his mother. That picture I showed you of Adonis, that's his mother next to him. So Jung is bringing in another difference between himself and Freud in discussing this incest theme, that incest is sometimes a psychological symptom, just like we saw with the father, or sometimes it is a symbol, it's a metaphor for the heroes turning back to the unknown part of themselves, symbolized by the mother, which we call the unconscious. So the descent and death of the hero, the death of the hero, and the descent of it into the maternal realm, which is incestuous, means a descent of our interest into the depths of ourselves. Why is it symbolized as incest? Because like is uniting with like. We are uniting with ourselves. And it can be experienced as disgusting to probe into one's inner self as it is to contemplate the possibility of incest with one's parents. A disgust has to be overcome. Everything in us at this point will fight that inner gaze, because we are taught from day one to get our energy out there and make a difference in the world. Now we are turning our energy inward and facing ourselves.
So that's kind of like incest in a metaphor.
So Jung is saying incest can be a literal, or not, I don't mean literally, but can be a psychological issue to face between the representing the child's dependence on the parents. Or it can have nothing to do with that, and it can be a metaphor for joining with yourself. And that's the kind of dreams, and that's the kind of imagery that's in that this myth. That's him now taking the hero myth one step further. It's not only about death and rebirth, It's a, in that death phase, you descend into a maternal realm, the maternal realm of the unconscious, which is what gives birth to you. That's why it's maternal. And that means overcoming fright or disgust or resistance, just as you would have that resistance to any kind of sexual contact with a relative.
So it must have, it has that resistance, I guess, in the same way.
This is to understand why it's so hard to do.
Right.
That we recoil against this. We recoil, I mean, it sounds so nice to say, hero, death, and rebirth, ha ha ha. But what it's really experienced as is as a repulsive demand to take our energy out of the world and into ourselves. Right.
And narcissism pushes us past that boundary.
How so?
Well, this vanity. I mean, in other words, vanity is the very thing that is pushing us through that boundary to actually give our total attention to ourselves.
You could look at it that way, yes. You could look at it that way.
So it's like as a culture, I mean, it's like even from the outside, the instincts have begun to work so that we're pushed, you know, it's like, okay, so there's an inner resistance to that, so on an external level, we get this push from the outside to make us be able to do that.
Yes, I agree.
Gary, then you're talking about vanity possibly being the driver. What you're saying is that gets you to that point, but then you're possessed by the vanity aspect of it.
Same thing. Yeah. It can be, it can, and here I am really thinking out loud, I'm not sure about any of this, but I think it's a concentration on the individual, but in narcissism per se, the energy is focused on the ego, where here the energy is focused on the unconscious. But by golly, they're awful similar. And is it possibly a meaning of our time that people are what looks like obsessed with their egos, and what the real meaning is to push them into being obsessed with their non-ego?
But could it be that, you know, what you said earlier, that you talked about, you know, being transfixed by the image?
Yes. Yeah.
We're so afraid to surrender our ego.
Absolutely.
We're just terrified of our ego.
Right.
We won't be in there.
So. Yeah. See, that's the incest taboo.
Heinz Kohout wrote an article, Forms and Transformations of Narcissism. And in that article, he discusses the meaning. He does discuss positive aspects of narcissism.
Mm-hmm.
Part of what you're talking about, I think, is that you need a certain amount of narcissism to write a book or do this or that and to cross the street. I think it's a really constructive way to think of narcissism having a span and the motivation rather than just thinking of it as a
to be correct in that language, I should say pathological narcissism, that there might really be still, I think the point still can stand, in what's typically called pathological narcissism, there could be behind that this drive to put energy inside.
Absolutely.
Yeah. But that's getting a bit off, but it's something we're dealing with all the time. Now, this is another one of those places where Jung goes off. And I will not go into it a whole lot, but let me just at least allude to it because your questions have been touching on it. I don't have this up on my website yet, but give me about a week, and this will be up on the website, and I'll put this up on my website at the URL listed in the back. What I've done is, and what Jung does, he takes this basic idea now of, so I'm putting a little parentheses to where we're going, just to show you how he expands on an idea. This basic idea that the hero dies and is reborn, and that death and rebirth is at the same time symbolized as an incestuous falling back into the maternal. And there's a whole range of myths that actually do, you can see them evolve chronologically from ancient Egypt through Mesopotamia about up to the Roman era. And this hero paradigm has different facets. In the earlier myths, the hero simply is beaten up, as Osiris was, and is thrown into the unconscious, into the maternal casket, the tree, etc. He really doesn't stand much of a chance. But over time, you can watch that hero get stronger and put up more and more and more of a fight. Where Osiris doesn't put up much of a fight. By the time you get to Marduk in Babylonia, and in the Roman era, it would be Mithras, rather than losing, they win. And what they defeat is a dragon. But the dragon, like the ocean, the tree, and so on, is another form of that maternal experience. And what Jung wants us to see is how this process of falling into the unconscious can be either passive or active. And the healthy situation is when it's active. So he gives the Osiris example just to give us some clue as to the nature of the paradigm, death and rebirth. But the later myths are the myths that are the healthier version of this, where the hero says, I'm going to conquer this dragon, I'm going to conquer this whale, or whatever it is, which would mean that there is a conscious intent to enter into that feminine space and reside there, as opposed to just falling into it. So it's the difference between somebody getting clobbered in life, falling apart, having a look at themselves, versus somebody saying, you know, I am not happy, I'm going to consciously take my energy, I'm going to consciously look at my inner world, I'm going to consciously focus on what needs to be learned. So that where her process occurs as something that happens to her, the best example is when we can actually take control of the situation and take our energy inside so that we don't have to get discombobulated or psychotic to hear these images, but we can willfully choose to go through this process. So that goes on a whole range of from Ra to Osiris, Marduk, Gilgamesh, Mithras, Christ. He goes to the Hiawatha legend. He talks about Wagner. He goes through many different hero myths to see, where is that hero? Is that hero falling into the feminine because it gets beat up? Or is that hero choosing to fight a battle where the victory over the negative appearing feminine creature would be the same as falling into the negative creature, but here it's a choice. Is that okay? Mm-hmm. And that, I've given you an outline if you want to follow. I've taken all the, it'll be up on the website. I've given all the major heroes he's talked about in those about three or four chapters. I've given you the paragraphs where he's talked about them, and then I try to see how he sees they develop. And they develop from falling in and getting nothing out of it, to falling in, getting something out of it, to fighting to get in, getting nothing out of it, fighting to get in, getting something out of it, and so on. There's a whole continuity. Yes?
This whole process, I'm trying to figure this out, it happens throughout life, but...
Yes?
But it also happens differently, I would presume, as we go through different stages of development.
In the healthy situation, it would happen each time there's a major shift. You know, going away to college, getting married, raising kids, establishing yourself in a career, working on the marriage, letting the kids go, you know, each of those major transition points, this would occur. If we have somehow been really messed up early on, when this thing comes back, it may come back with more vengeance. So a given first descent might be harder than the subsequent ones. And you might think that, oh gosh, what I'm going through now is just an isolated example. No, you've just been spared the other ones for a while. Now you're getting it full force. But what we're trying to learn by going through one of them is what it feels like the next time around, so that rather than being swept away and having to go through a destructive set of circumstances to get inside, so that we're not Osiris, so that we're more like Marduk or something. Yeah.
You know, when you say that the later ones are more healthy than the other ones, than the earlier ones, do you mean that they're evolved further?
Well, I think each subsequent one would take you, you know, here I, you know, Jung doesn't of course talk this way, but those of you who know Erikson's stages of development, I think each stage of development, there's another shift. There's another one of these processes. And the first one is hard because you don't know when you die that you're ever going to come back again.
Right.
Once you have died, so to speak, metaphorically, once you've let the hero bring you inside, once you have let yourself fall apart, and you know the experience of being lost, and then you know the experience of being put back together again by your dreams, the next time it comes around, there isn't as much panic. And you're much more likely to cooperate. And I think it doesn't have to be as dramatic, and when you feel it starting, you don't have to wait for a bankruptcy or a divorce or a bar fight to realize, I'm in a crisis here, that you more likely go with this process. And in that sense, then the hero moves from being something that you are subject to something that you choose. It still represents the death and rebirth. But you are cooperating with it so that the process doesn't have to be as uprooting.
Is it possible that people fall into the resort?
Right, which is what she does. She felt, well, I think she must have gotten out. It sounds like the treatment was healthy. We're going to now be, Jung is now going to be talking about, okay, let's look at those hero myths that don't work. That's why he does this huge canvassing of the hero myth throughout all of world culture. How does it go wrong? Well, one of the things I think he's going to say is it typically goes wrong is that the hero remains transfixed with what is. It can't, let me say it differently. The individual stays transfixed with the hero image, which means that the descent really never can fulfill itself coming back up again. It won't. The individual can't see there has to be a past and a future. It's just enamored of the experience. What makes the difference in the hero myth is whether the hero can make a sacrifice or not. So what has to happen is the individual has to be able to make a sacrifice in order to make this process creative. So this is where Jung now starts investigating this myth to look at what goes wrong, what goes right. At each stage of our little diagram, he dives in depth to look at the full extent of what that process means. You could say that there are two dangers. One, that you never get in, and two, once you're in, you don't get out. And you generally, you know, you don't get in because you don't recognize there's a problem. She gets in because she's intoxicated with this image. When she's intoxicated with this image, she's already in. But she can't work symbolically to realize she has to give up her literal wish for what that image refers to and receive its symbolic meaning. So the absence of the sacrifice means you don't get out. The absence of the sacrifice means you can't get out. She will stay stuck on being thrilled with the beauty of her poetry.
And that is the sacrifice.
Giving that up is the sacrifice. Right. Yeah.
Well, what would you define as her wish?
Her original wish?
Yes, her wish.
Well, her original wish, it appears, was for the sailor. But the real dynamic behind that you could say, is the wish of the self that she changes.
Yeah, but she's not aware of that. She's not aware of the wish for the sailor. But what does she believe that her wish is?
I think what she's experiencing is a fascination with her own imagery. She gets drunk on her poetry. This is what enraptures her. That's what she can't let go of.
Is there a wish in there?
Well, a wish for the image.
Okay, so the wish is for that image is sort of a God image.
Yes.
So her wish is for that.
Right.
That God image.
Okay. Right. Rather than seeing that there's a deeper wish of the self for her growth, letting go of her wish for the God image and saying, oh, that's a message, that's not an object.
And how does she become conscious of that?
Well, that's what therapy would be for, as far as Jung's concerned, to just literally tell her this stuff. Yeah. Here, we have to take this imagery seriously, but we can't literalize it. It's metaphor. And you can err in ignoring, a lot of people in a rational society who have to work 9 to 5 will err in not admitting the reality of this experience. She has already admitted the reality. She just can't see it on the right level. Kate?
I'm just curious, short of therapy or something like that, is there a way that some people can recognize me a little bit symbolically?
I think this is what a good friendship would do. It would shock the person out of their fantasy level of appreciation, and then nature would take over and lead them to where they're going. In a way, that's enviable, but in another way, you know, we've been been talking about the glass half empty, but there's a very beautiful process that happens out of this, is that you get a creative voice that you wouldn't ordinarily have. And I think that's the value of going through it this way. You know, this is what remember when Jung is writing this? 1912, 1913, he's going down, man. And he's going down hard, and I think he's telling himself by writing this book, if I go down, will I ever come up? And if I go down, why should I go down? And if I go down, what do I look for? And what we've come up with when he came up is Jungian psychology. So you can see it can have a really positive benefit, and that's, I think, the value of its synthetic happening when we try to augment it in therapy. What he sacrificed, he sacrificed the relationship with Freud. But if you remember about this time, if you have read Memory, Dreams, Reflections, I think it's in the chapter Confrontation with the Unconscious, he dreamt of killing Siegfried. And Siegfried he took to be the Germanic power drive. So that was his sacrifice. He was a guy on the way up. And he sacrificed all of that. And for the rest of his life, he was basically excluded by the Society of Zurich. He was marginalized by any sort of power structures there. He never really got to teach at the university. Imagine this stuff. And he wasn't allowed to teach this at the university. And he said, okay, if you're not going to let me speak my voice, then I'll choose my voice. I think that was for him part of it.
Aaron, did you say that he had a similar experience early in his life that when he'd already been through kind of a descent early on?
I don't think so. I think it was touch and go.
I'm just thinking of something really dreamy in memory of his reflection. It seemed like they were going down.
Well, that's certainly true. I think his first dream, yeah.
Yeah, he went down multiple layers.
Yeah. You know, I think the person who meant so much for Jung at this point was Nietzsche, and rather than saying Jung had a precedent in his own life, I think he had a precedent in Nietzsche. And he saw when Nietzsche went down, he didn't come up. And Jung was saying, holy smokes, is that going to be me? So by looking at Nietzsche's errors, he realized what he should not do. And that saved him. Basically,
did he go crazy? Or
yeah, he went crazy.
He
yeah.
The thing that he had to say, that he thought, you know, he had some understanding of it to be able to even recognize that what he was doing was very reaching, like, to have some of that own stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that was his classical education.
Yeah.
But if you're interested, the difference between Jung and Nietzsche was he felt, I understand this stuff now. Now I must communicate it. And if I'm going to communicate it, I've got to communicate it with the level of consciousness of the people I'm trying to communicate in mind. That's why he went to science, to describe all these images in a way that anyone with, you know, a reasonable mind could begin to build a bridge between these dreams and the images and experience. Where Nietzsche sat up on his golden tower and said, oh, you fools, here's the truth. Oops, I'm alone. I don't think I want to live anymore. Jung said, I can't do that. I've got to communicate it in a way that I understand who it is I'm speaking to.
It was almost like a generosity
spirit. It really was, yeah.
Eros.
It was Eros, and I think that saved him. That he knew he had to communicate it or go crazy. And he couldn't communicate it in the heroic way, you see what I mean? He couldn't identify with the hero. That's why he had to kill Siegfried. He couldn't identify, he couldn't be the big shot speaking the truth. He had to speak in a way that honest people could understand if they made half an effort. Now, that held him up through 1944. And by that time, you know, he had gained confidence. We'll see the last books we'll be talking about in subsequent workshops. He said, I don't care. I'm going to tell it like Nietzsche did, sort of. I mean, I'm just going to tell it like it is. If you get it or not, I don't care. Because I've got my house, I've got my career, I don't need that resonance anymore. And that makes those later works harder, but in a way more interesting, because it's the pure stuff.
Can you lose grounding them? You know, Anthony Stoll wrote a book about Peter Clay.
Uh-huh.
He mentioned Jung as kind of losing touch towards the end and getting more like a guru.
More like a what?
A guru. Did he lose
it? I don't think so. You know, it's funny, we were just talking. Actually, I have it. I'll return it. Go to the library and check out Matter of Heart, the DVD version. And that's an interview with Jung's students. That's not what I'm talking about. But appended to that is a 20-minute interview of Jung at Balingen in 1950, well, about the time he wrote this. Jung was 75. What year would have that been? 1950. And see if you think he's ungrounded or not.
Well, I don't think he was ungrounded.
Yeah, I don't either. Not from that video.
But this is, you know, I mean, I think a lot of Anthony Storr, I really think a great deal.
Uh-huh.
He was probably a sensei, too. You know, and he was seeing him later in life. And if Jung was getting more confident and deeper into the unconscious himself as coming to the end of his life, I just wondered what was in his saying that.
I don't know. Some of you heard the story, bear with me, but and we'll take a break. Well, we'll go for a little bit more, I forget. We go to 3:30. I got the story secondhand. Friend of mine's friend was in the restaurant that Jung used to go to. Some of you all know this story? No, no. You know, Jung had this summer home in Balingen, right? And Jung used to walk up to the next town and have dinner with the farmers every now and then, smoke a cigar and drink a glass of wine. And my friend's friend was in this restaurant shortly after Jung died. And overheard, they call him the Wirt, the owner, it's like a family-run restaurant, the owner, cook, waiter, lamenting that old man Jung had died. And saying what a tragedy it was, because Jung was the last decent stonemason on this side of the Lake of Zurich. He thought Jung was a bricklayer. So it doesn't sound to me like it's a guy who's ungrounded.
Here,
yes.
This, you were talking about this simple concept of lasting capacity and
yes.
kind of what we were talking about. And if as a therapist, you're union and you talk to this person, say, Ms. Miller, and tell her, you know, your glass is half empty, then that's reality. And that's her choice then to look at it and say, okay, glass is half empty. I can wallow in that. Or I can say, your glass is half empty. Maybe I should fill it up.
Yeah.
So it's not saying the glass is half empty. It's nothing really negative. It all becomes a perceptive choice on the part of the
yeah. And
so a person who thinks the glass is half full could be in exact shape.
Yeah. Yeah, I think the final point here is to help the individual see what that image is trying to add to the quality of their life. And sometimes by holding on to what looks like literal meaning of that image is just the way to not get what it's trying to give to your life.
And then the second thing is back to the original poem or whatever,
yeah.
51,
uh-huh.
is actually very mystically oriented, and that makes me wonder what's the differentiation between her becoming a mystical poet like Rumi and her becoming a schizophrenic. Maybe that's something I didn't.
Well, I don't think Rumi was above chopping wood and carrying water, but see, she would have been.
Okay.
But this imagery was pulling her away from life. Where Rumi, you can just feel how connected he was with life. Mm-hmm. I think, again...
The whole development of the mystical process and hearing, you know, getting this image, you just, you know, what's the difference between the choice of she made and the choice of Rumi? I mean, what keeps the person, or what makes it a healthy choice?
I would say understanding the meaning of what's been written.
Okay.
And again, your question's a good point a good place to remember. Jung is always saying this process is a healthy one. The production of the image is a healthy one. It is not an unhealthy one, a la the psychoanalytic approach. There's nothing wrong with the production of these mystical images. It's how do you understand them. That's the difference. Yes. That's what she doesn't want to give up.
But then she would have to follow something.
But then she probably, I mean, our faith is that what you do generate is the real thing. And it will not be as likely to pull you away from life, but to push you into life. But, you know, I mean, I think that's another way of saying what I just said about she gets transfixed by the imagery. She might say, well, I don't want to give up my creativity. But it's pseudo-creativity.
Your poetry sucks.
But she didn't think so. And just try telling somebody, your poetry sucks, you know.
Might it also be said that if it's true creativity or real creativity, that leads to greater connectedness?
It won't go away.
Yeah, if it's not, it leads to isolation. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And probably because she went through some conflict.
Well, I think she went. Because she wasn't when she first saw. I'll have to check whether he was a Freudian or not. I don't know whether he was a Freudian analyst or just a sympathetic counselor. I really don't know. Okay, well, that's the whole hero myth stuff. And just so you remember, there's a range of of the death and rebirth. That's one of the main points. And that you remember that the death phase is depicted as an incest, so that death and incest are the same thing. And that can be symbolized in many, many different ways, ending up, starting off with a purely passive individual or hero to a very active hero who slays the dragon. In that case, the dragon would be, slaying the dragon would be tantamount to Osiris's falling into the ocean, but out of a conscious choice. And that interested Jung very much. Yeah.
I think that this is one of the image that's behind the female teachers having sex with their male students.
Okay. One more there, the fight with the nocturnal serpent, paragraph 375, accordingly signifies conquest of the mother. That's what I just said. And the different stages in the development of the hero myth, as I said, it goes from paragraph 350 to paragraph 550, you know, about 100 and some pages. And I'll try to outline that for you, which will be up on the website, if you should ever want to tackle it.
Is that why you can allow the rituals in so-called primitive society? There's that stark separation between the women and
yes.
the men in terms
yeah.
of the rituals and so forth, because yeah. the women are thought to be dangerous.
Yes. Well,
and their powers.
Right. It's a little bit more complicated, but as you probably know, the greatest crime in so-called primitive societies is incest. Now, a friend of mine is actually Australian. He goes to Australia every now and then to live among the Aborigines. And he said, you know, you kill somebody, you kiss the wrong person, you wake up with a spear in your belly the next morning. It is absolutely the strongest law. Now, Freud would say, well, you see, that just shows how strong the incest taboo is, how strong incest is forbidden. And that shows you how much it is a biological fact. It's a social fact. It's a realistic fact. Jung is saying, you know, I don't disagree with that, but that doesn't mean that every time it appears in dreams that that's what it refers to. It can also appear in dreams as a metaphor. And what it shows is not your social taboo against incest, but your fear of contacting yourself. Yeah, that's and you can see by this time Freud's about throwing the book in the fireplace, because Jung has disputed the sexual nature of libido. Remember, it's not sexual. It may be sexual, but it's a quality less energy. And just because it expresses itself sexually doesn't mean it's sexual. He's questioned the fact that imagery in dreams are substitute formations. They are symbols in his mind, and now he's completely thrown out what Freud has said, which is the basis of his work, that the incest complex is the cause of neurosis. Jung is saying maybe could also be a metaphor. So he's undercut each of Freud's basic suppositions, not saying they're false, but they need to be reinterpreted, and then that was the end of their friendship. Okay, how are we doing? Shall we take a break?